Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of The Exchange, presented by Confederation Group. I'm Sam McPhail, and with me is my co-host Blake Doyle, and we are excited to get underway after much anticipation. How are you doing today, Blake?
I am great. Couldn't be happier. This is great to be here. It's great. Really excited about launching this thing. And we've had a lot of conversations internally. This is really, it's neat, the genesis of where this came from, but we've had a lot of conversation. We've got some really interesting people participating, lined up and recorded. And we got a great first guest on the inaugural episode of The Exchange.
And I think it's kind of odd coming from someone like you and myself. Both of us, our political backgrounds wouldn't exactly line up with our first guest, but I think that's important to kind of encompass that we're a very global view on things versus just our own little kind of cohorts or groups.
So it is, but we live in a collaborative environment, so you're right. Not that we're focused on a certain party color. We've got the leader of Her Majesty's official opposition, and not that we're not necessarily line. The views are all pretty homogenized, I think, in legislatures.
Right.
Hard, actually, I don't know as a voter, how you really distinguish one from the other. And, you know, if it's a collaborative environment, everyone gets along, you know, when it comes back to the polls, how do you choose one color over another? Or is it just this blended turquoise of different colors all combined?
Yeah, definitely. And I know, I think our goal isn't to just focus on politics per se, but I think having this kind of introductory guest in Peter Bevan Baker will kind of open people's eyes to say, okay, maybe these guys can see past their party lines or party colors or whatever the case may be. And I'm excited. I think a lot of people are kind of anticipating. Our interview with him was probably about 40 minutes or so. It was a good conversation.
Great
we had
conversation.
With him.
He's a political affairs contributor to PEI. He's got a lot of great perspectives. He's a genuine politician. He contributes to the legislature, the fabric of life, and he certainly was very welcoming and transparent in our conversation.
I think, and he definitely has a pretty big reach in terms of just different demographics because it's the new party. They don't have as much of a background, so I think people are a little more inclined to maybe see what he's about. So I think we'll see some more viewers that way. So I guess Blake and I kind of decided that we would kind of divide our podcasts into little segments, just so we can kind of keep consistency. This includes a political eyed one, an economy/business one, and then obviously our interview and usually some sort of wrap up at the end. So to lead into our first segment on politics, it's called Political Pundits. And I'll let Blake kind of discuss maybe the last week in politics or last couple weeks in politics on PEI and in a national stage as well.
It's a pretty quiet time in politics at this time of year. It's really the most active period of politics is when the sessions are in, legislative sessions, and you've got different parties either jockeying to get their message out or to discredit a message or at least challenge it. So it's been quiet outside of the fact of a few big notable events. We've got a federal leadership race underway. We talk about that a little bit with Peter Bevan Baker, but so there's people entering politics, there's people exiting politics, as we saw just on the weekend.
Yeah, so even I guess it was as soon as Monday that the Newfoundland and Labrador Premier Dwight Ball resigned, and there wasn't a whole lot of kind of explanation. He said family time, but you never know, that could mean anything. From
that's a veiled comment.
That's
politics.
I think that's said often. And I've met Dwight Ball numerous times when I worked in the Premier's office here in PEI. And he's a really good guy, and I always had a lot of time for him. Actually, a funny story that I had with him was he was here for the Atlantic Premier's meetings last January, maybe, whenever it was. I met him earlier in the week, and it was time for him to go to the airport. And let's just say we were running a little late, and I was in charge of driving. So if there's any police officers listening, just cover your ears. Because from the Delta all the way to the airport, I think it took maybe a maximum of 4 minutes. So it was a bit of a...
That's only a 3-minute ride, so that's okay. You're, it sounds like you did the right
thing. I took the helicopter. No, but I think he thought it was pretty funny too. So that's a memory I have of him. And obviously anybody in political life contributes a lot, but in the Premier stage, you can contribute a lot, even if it's over a short period of time. And I'm sure he'll be missed in some aspects. So right now there was supposed to be a leadership review in June of the Liberal Party had their own in Newfoundland. So I think he was probably feeling the pressures of that as well.
That's what the sense I
that we may not know about it. And just from what I've read, some big cabinet ministers were kind of pushing him out in a sense anyways. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. Whenever Dwight Ball was on his way out, he mentioned that the next budget, he wants there to be a new leader, and that's less than 2 months away. So it'll be a quick leadership process, and it'll be interesting to see what actually happens with that, because rushing things isn't always the best idea, but who knows?
You know, some of these, even regionally, some of the legislatures are clearly tenuous, because we've got minority, we've got fragile governments, and you can see even where there's a governing party, there's some fragility and jockeying. So unrewarding time maybe to be in politics, but and we do talk about that a little bit with our guest. So make sure you tune into the latter part of this segment to hear what Peter's perceptions on of a lot of things, including collaboration.
Another thing, just in the political pundits section, is that it's been pretty big news in terms of the blockades. And we've experienced that locally now. At the Confederation Bridge, there was a protester just kind of saying, we stand with the pipeline protesters out west or wherever it is. I think that's kind of a very good example that in federal politics or provincial, that there's never a win-win situation. And Trudeau right now is dealing with this, and he actually canceled his trip to the Caribbean this week. He wasn't on vacation, don't worry.
Whoa. How many trips this guy made?
He was out political business, but it's just an example that you can never win, because there's always something, you're going to offend someone in some way. And obviously this is a big decision and they can't take it lightly. And that's why he's kind of dealing with the local premiers across the country. And we see it even on our island at the Confederation Bridge. So
it's a big issue.
It's hard to, and I don't really know enough about it to speak at it at length, but it's pretty intense when you have the prime minister calling our premier saying, what's going on?
Yeah. Well, and you know, I guess it's incumbent on our federal leaders to resolve this issue. You know, this is a longstanding grievance, and I guess we can't have disruption in our ability to get our goods to and from markets. So pretty crucial issue, and it hasn't bubbled up too much beyond these isolated events. Now they're expanding, but it's an issue that at the federal level, you know, has to be some accommodation.
So don't think politics is easy if you're going to get into it, because this is a daily thing, these kind of decisions. A buzzword, so that's a kind of the national reach for that little part, but so provincially on PEI, collaboration has been a buzzword for the past number of months.
But, you know, what is collaboration? So, you know, is it an authentic action, or is this just political expediency? Is it a word that kind of satisfies a moment to bridge you through to the next election?
Or brings people together kind of thing, yeah.
And I think the first year, I believe that there was a genuine attempt to have a collaborative approach to governing, and there was additional voices on committees. I don't know how long this will last.
I think that was pretty evident, even with our interview with Peter, that it is starting to maybe dwindle a bit, because he later that day, the day we interviewed him, he released an article or a blog post on the official opposition website saying that maybe government's forgetting about good governance. So I think that you can kind of see the seams unwinding a bit. And it's not to say that it can't be fixed, but I think we've had the phase this past year, the phase of collaboration, and now it's time to figure out what's next. How do we make decisions, including everybody, but not relying on the term collaboration to guide us through the next step.
And the province does have to progress and move forward. We've got to pass legislation. Hopefully they find a way. I mean, I think the electorate did elect a, I don't know, what would we call it, a proportional representative.
Yeah, like a multi, yeah. Like it's the first time we've had three legitimate parties in a sizable amount of seats. Obviously, right. The Liberals didn't do as hot as I would have hoped, but still have six seats, and that's pretty...
It's a lot. That's
still a lot
of
votes. Exactly. That's still a lot of votes in the legislature. The Green Party with 8, and then the governing Tories with 13, I guess, would be the math. Unless...
So they're incumbent to find a way to work together.
Exactly.
To meet their mandate, whether or not... I personally think that the environment is wrong. I just don't think it's... Despite best efforts, and I believe that the Premier and the leaders of the... various parties are committed to trying to work together, and even if they are, I don't know that the system will allow them to. So we'll see
what happens. And we're just pundits in this. We don't know everything for fact, but this is our observation and what we're hearing on the streets, and what we're getting the pulse of things, I guess you could say, in the greater Charlottetown area and beyond. So now we are going to move into our next segment, which kind of focuses on economy and business locally and nationally. So this will be the first ever edition of Economy Experts with Blake Doyle.
And Sam McPhail.
And Sam McPhail.
Yeah. So the incubus of this whole process really came from the Guardian article. So I've been, I guess, an op-ed business writer for Saltwire now, which was formerly the Guardian, still is the Guardian, but owned by Saltwire. long time, maybe 18, 19 years, far too long, honestly. But we continue to write kind of provocative statements about business and as it pertains to local issues. We had some videos that we broadcast to kind of reinforce the messaging that we're putting out through these bi-weekly newspaper op-eds. And Sam's idea actually was to how do we harness that, maybe build something a little bit bigger in a different format. And this podcast is really the genesis of that conversation. We've got some neat infrastructure now. We've got a lot of people interested to be part of it. A lot of people have seen what we're doing and seem quite interested. So the economics part is really kind of driven from some of the articles that we've looked at or some of the content we've looked at in The Guardian over the last bit. So last week, we've got a great one, I think, coming up this week, which is going to underline sort of what I see happening in the undercurrent of sentiment. So the economy is strong, and is that sort of felt by everybody? And I guess we'll explore that maybe next week. But the previous week, we looked at minimum wage and a strong economy. The question really was, what comes first, a strong economy or wage inflation?
Chicken or the egg?
Yeah, it's tough. I don't know. Nobody knows, I guess. But there are economists who look at these things, and from my observation, we couldn't really find a definitive answer. What I can tell you, a few little stats, that the first minimum wage was set initially in 1961, and it was 0.375 cents.
I thought that was minimum wage today. That's what I get paid.
That is what you get paid. You shouldn't report that, because I don't think I'm allowed to pay that much legally. But that was for a 48-hour work week. And, you know, there's been a lot of deviations. They had a different wage rate for waitresses. So there have been all kinds of amendments along this continuum of managing wage growth. Containing wage growth, I don't know, depending on how you look at it. Presently, the minimum wage in April of this year is going to rise to $12.85 an hour. So we've come a long way from when this is first introduced. One thing I didn't look at, and I'd be interested, is what has inflation been over that period? Mm-hmm. And I didn't check it, but I would suggest that I'm not sure that minimum wage has kept pace with inflation. No.
And that's kind of reflective on whether you're renting an apartment or getting groceries. It's just kind of like, okay, it's a lot harder to keep up than it would have been even 10 years ago, because I don't think the inflation is caught up to
the wage.
The wage growth.
Certainly energy is a big component of it, and now housing would be a much larger part of that basket of CPI goods. So there was an experiment done in Seattle where they've increased the minimum wage. And by 2021, it's going to be $15 an hour. And that compares with the average minimum wage in the U.S., which is around $7.25. I think that's the average federal minimum wage rate. And that'll vary by state. So every state has the ability to kind of amend.
Or subsidize it or whatever.
Increase it based on their legislation. But $7.25 an hour in the states, now it's a different tax regime. It's much, much more progressive. In fact, they don't tax people as aggressively, but maybe they don't enjoy the same services we do here. They also rely more on gratuity in the states, more common to tip. So there's right. additional elements that contribute to your minimum wage. And that tends to be lower wage service sector, and they do get tips and other things. $7.25 an hour in the U.S. equates to about $9.55 Canadian. So another study I looked at suggested that the average livable wage in the states, across all states, is $16.14 an hour. So there's still some disparity between what's manageable and you know, what's being provided. In this study, what's happened in Seattle really was probably some unexpected economic consequences. So they raised the wage. A few things occurred, one of which, people who were holding multiple jobs to kind of manage their needs in the economy didn't have to do that anymore. So there was a restructuring the labor market.
Otherwise, you'd see a definite drop in labor if you only had one job versus three.
And it's a time when the economy's strong in the States. So the economy can't really absorb the loss of that labor, not unlike PEI. So there's, you know, I guess that's a great case study. But what it comes back to, you know, if you increase the wages, is that going to create more disposable income in the economy? Is it going to create more growth? Is it going to create more spending? And which comes first? Raising the wages or a buoyant economy? Was one drive the other? That's the chicken and egg. That's what we discussed
in recent article. Yeah, and I think it's good to kind of think about these things, because we wouldn't really see what the differences are in the United States versus in Canada. I think Atlantic Canada, all the minimum wages are fairly similar, in terms maybe off by like 10 cents or 15 cents. It's not a crazy. But it's definitely, especially my, let's say my age range, because a lot of my friends would be working closer to minimum wage anyways, or in service sector or whatever the case may be. But it's kind of, it's for someone like my age, they wouldn't probably think about that at all, because they, okay, I got the paycheck coming every 2 weeks, regardless of what I make. But if you think about what you have to do in the next 6 months, I've got to buy a new car, I got to get a new apartment, I got to pay tuition, whatever the case may be. It's interesting to think about how do we all get ahead in terms of minimum wage.
And the apartment accommodation cost is a big component now.
I guess affordable housing is like at like 30% of income, roughly. Is that?
I'm not even sure. I think that's correct. But around the threshold.
But for some people, that might be like...
Might be 50%.
It might even be higher than that. But some people might say, well, that's not... Even 30% is not affordable. Like, I can't do anything else for fun, even if I use 30% of my income for my housing.
So then it gets to a point of what do you put your money into? Do you get medicine or do you get accommodation?
Right.
Do you buy food?
Or a salad, or a $2 cheeseburger.
Well, it's even more. I think in some cases, it's much more profound as far as security.
Big time.
And, you know, do you have a reliable, safe place to lay your head
down?
Well,
it's also the rainy day fund. Like, with tomorrow, you could, I don't know, for example, if my car didn't pass inspection, I had to put $1,000 into it. Not everybody has that little
cushion,
their own slush fund. Okay, I need this for... I didn't expect this, but I have this money set aside. A lot of people would be ended up walking to work or taking the bus or whatever the case would be, because they don't have that little cushion to help them get through the next paycheck.
Or maybe you don't eat one meal a day. Like, I think it's,
yeah, well, it
there's
gets,
profound
it's, there's
challenge.
Definitely, especially it gets to mental health alone, but also physical health because of what you're eating, what you're doing.
Right.
But I think the mental stresses of it are even more kind of emphasized today.
So it's a big economic consideration.
Big consideration.
There's no solution to it, just an observation of the chicken or egg, which is more important. And there'd certainly be people who would argue either side of that equation, I think. So.
Big time. And that's constantly being studied. It's not like it's, whether we know it or not, governments or private sector, where they're studying this to make sure. Well, Seattle's a perfect example. They did it so they could study it down the road, probably.
Well, in business, are fundamentally not opposed to raising the wage, but it's an input cost. And anytime the input cost increases, it's passed on.
They have
on.
To find something else to offset it, essentially.
Or you pass it on to consumers. So it, again, causes this rotation of inflation. Every time the wage goes up, eventually your consumable goods go up, and the benefit of the increased wage is diminished.
I guess we could say there's no perfect answer to the wage.
No, just an observation. Thankfully, we've got good people in the legislature managing this stuff. We can just observe it.
We can just talk about it and hopefully give ideas. So locally, there's been one part of our provincial economy that's been growing exponentially is our growth in the cannabis industry. So we have two...
Well, interesting. Yes, we do. I'll let you talk about... So there's been growth in jobs. The industry itself is under duress. So if you look at the markets, every cannabis participant has had their stock whacked in this last 9 months.
I was more so talking about the jobs.
I know. And it's a good news story, but there's another side of this thing, too. There is rationalization of the market. And, you know, another consideration is the government receipts. Tax revenue has been abysmal from the cannabis sale.
From selling it provincially,
So I've really taken kind of burst your bubble on
you. Yeah, no, I do. I'm just saying it from the point of view of jobs, because both Figure and DoseCan that are actually, they're on, I guess it's called Cannabis Corner in the, I'm trying to think of what the road's called.
In the BioCommons.
BioCommons, right. Yeah. But I think they both kind of are planning to add over 100 jobs in the next kind of year to 2 years or whatever the case may be. And that'd be from anything from senior level to production to shipping, whatever the case may be.
So that's a success story in an environment where there's compression and there is rationalization and the stock market's dropping, and you've got two participants in our economy that are growing. I think that's unique, and it's absolutely unique, and it's a great testament to the kind of firms that are investing in PEI. And a lot of places, Leamington and some other hotbeds for cannabis in Canada, are not enjoying that same luxury.
Right, especially, like, I think I would say Toronto's kind of like the hub for it in terms of the, whether it's the kind of grow, like the
head office,
the title
there.
Company that holds it, exactly.
But the growth is all happening in the agricultural belt.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we're experiencing the good parts of that right now in terms of job growth and almost like a buzz for it, because they're like, 4 or 5 years ago, even longer than that, I guess, but you'd never think of you growing weed legally in PEI, and there's two massive producers of that are doing a very good job of it.
And a funny choice of descriptors there, a buzz. There is a buzz.
There is a buzz. Speaking of buzz, what would be the Exchange podcast without talking about both weed and beer? But the craft beer industry is also pretty propped up recently on PEI, and it continues to grow. And now we have 8 breweries in total, and I'm sure there'll be more down the road as time goes on. But we were up to Lone Oak not long ago, just to kind of, we know a couple of the guys there and kind of pick their brain. And it's pretty crazy to see how big that's grown even in the past 5 years, because there was really only, let's say, PEI Brewing Company, and then all of a sudden there's 7 more within 5 years.
I wonder, so one thing we need to see, so the market share for beer consumption, I assume, hasn't changed. So people are probably moving away from traditional suppliers of beer.
And right, the local macro brewery versus micro.
Yeah. So are the big guys, is their market share shrinking? Is that why they're buying some micro?
Especially when the micro ones aren't really charging a whole lot more, so why wouldn't you support for an extra $2 a case or something? What's the difference?
And there's some uniqueness to it. I think there's a whole industry now. So this Thursday, there's a Battle of the Brews. Is that what it's called?
Right. Yeah. So at Hop Yard, yeah, Battle of the Brews is the final. So it's Copper Bottom at a Montague.
Yeah.
And Lone Oak is taking, they're going to battle off to see who wins.
So get there if you're out about Thursday.
We'll be there, so you'll see us there.
Vote for which beer you think is most successful. But all these local market craft brewers, they drive tourism. It's an attraction for people who want to go to a certain area and try what flavors represent that local area. So it's a great great opportunity for PEI. And there's a lot of successful craft breweries here. And you know what? I think there should be some diversion from just craft beer, maybe into some other products unique to PEI. And I think maybe you'll see that.
Yeah, with
happen.
Local products or local whatever.
Well, ciders, or, you know, there's other products.
And it's continually growing. I guess if you encountered ciders, it'd probably be, there'd be two other cideries, the Red Island and then the two Scott. What was it? Two Scots, three apples, something like that. Yeah. They're in Riverdale, but the same idea, like they're strictly ciders.
So I think there'll be more and
there'd be more of that, and more unique stuff, and especially as like ready-to-drink beverages, whether they're vodka sodas or whatever, they're going to become more readily available, I think, as time goes on as well.
So hopefully all these firms can continue to diversify.
Yeah, we're going to have more, we're going to have to Go to the bars more often, I guess, to meet.
I'll leave that to you.
Yeah, I can do that for you.
You can be the sample.
I guess before we jump into the Peter Bevan Baker interview, is there anything else you wanted to touch on, Blake?
No, I'm just excited about this. I think there's an appetite for what it is we're trying to accomplish here. And if people have suggestions on content, if you have comments on what you've seen or heard, if you think there's ways to improve or different people that should be participating, we're open for that. We're just looking to have another vehicle to communicate to Islanders and allow Islanders to participate in that communication.
I agree.
And, you know, really excited again. This is the inaugural launch of the Exchange. It's hosted by Confederation Group. And we're really excited to have somebody of Peter Bevan Baker's stature as the first guest. Not somebody, obviously, that would be from our political backgrounds, but he is the very exceptional politician. He's the leader of the opposition. And he's got lots.
I don't think he's going anywhere anytime soon either. So
no, and there's been the legislative change is probably a good thing. It represents
It shows that PEI is like, I guess we're going back to politics, but it shows that PEI is willing to make those little changes versus maybe somewhere else wouldn't be as
progressive.
With our smaller population, it's a little easier to kind of implement those changes for some things versus others, I suppose. Anyways,
just not pop cans, not a bridge. There's things we're slow.
A lot of things. Anyways, we're going to tune it over to the Peter Bevan Baker interview. Peter Bevan Baker was first elected to the Legislative Assembly of PEI on May 4th, 2015, in District 17, Kelly's Cross, Cumberland, as the first ever Green Party MLA. He was re-elected on April 23rd, 2019 in a newly named district of New Haven, Rocky Point, and subsequently became the leader of the official opposition as he led the Green Party to a total of 8 seats in the legislature. Originally from Aberdeen, Scotland, he now resides in Hampton, PEI with his wife Anne, where he was previously a dentist since 2002. Tenacity is no stranger to Peter. He first ran for office in 1993 in the riding of Leeds-Grenville in Ontario. Since then, he had run unsuccessfully 9 more times, both provincially and federally. But do you think that stopped him? After trial and error, he finally seized victory in the 2015 provincial election, earning almost 55% of the vote, and hasn't looked back since. Please welcome to the Exchange, the leader of the Green Party of PEI, the happy dentist, Peter Bevan Baker.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's great to be here. Nice to see you too, Blake.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you here. And it's great to have the leader of the Her Majesty's official opposition here talking in exchange. And you, Sam, probably should be doing intros for movies. That's pretty much it.
I'll work on that.
So you've had a long, committed political career.
Yeah.
You've been focused on serving public in many facets. You've got tenacity. You've stayed with your commitment to represent people. Tell us about that journey and how you got started, going from, you know, some attempts and unsuccessful attempts to leader the opposition.
Sure. Well, I mean, you refer to it as tenacity, and that's a sort of positive word. Some might call it stubbornness or, you know, ignorance or that sort of unwillingness to give up. And, you know, in many respects, I am the king of futility when it comes to, or I was anyway until 4 years ago, when it comes to politics, because I did, you're right, you know, why would you carry on after 20-something years of spectacular, consistent failure to carry on doing that? What was it that kept you going? And then, I mean, there's a very simple one-word answer to that, and it's kids. I started in my political career, if you can call it that, shortly after I had Kate, our first child. And it was sort of projecting forward 20, 30 years to the world that they were going to have to grow up in. So, I mean, some of my kids are the same age as you, Sam. And looking at what I saw and not feeling terribly good about that. And I wanted to be a good dad. I was determined to be a devoted dad, and I was. But it seemed like there was little point to me in raising four good citizens if the world in which they were going to have to live their lives out was going to, you know, turn into rat shit. That did not seem like a good plan to me. So regardless of the job I could do independently as a dad, I wanted to make a contribution to what I could see as improving the world in which they were going to live. And I'm not just talking environmentally, I'm talking socially and economically as well, because in all three areas I could see massive problems developing even 30 years ago. Mm. So politics is a place where you make those big decisions, those collective decisions that will determine the trajectory of where our society is going. And so I thought, well, you know, that's where I should devote my energies. But never did I imagine that I would actually ever get elected. You know, I spent all of those years in the political wilderness as a failed Green candidate, because I wanted, if I ever was to become successful, I did not want to end up as a sitting member of a legislature and to have somebody standing behind me, tapping me on the shoulder, poking me, telling me what I had to say, how I had to vote, how I had to behave. I wanted the independence and the freedom that comes with either being an independent member or aligning yourself with a party that gives you that liberty. And so it was really important to me that if I was actually going to do this as a, you know, as part of my life, which it now is, it's all of my life in many respects, that I wanted to do it on my terms. And I wanted to be sincerely and authentically Peter Bevan Baker. And I'm really proud, I suppose, and certainly very happy to have ended up with that possibility here in PEI.
So just this is a question just of the legislature. So as an observer, not involved at all, but certainly an interested observer of politics, you're kind of limited by this political structure. And today you've got a collaborative kind of arrangement. I'm curious how that will work out and play out in the next couple of sessions.
Me too.
But you do have the constraints of a political structure, and you've got other members that you know are jockeying for different things, both on opposition and government side. Is it everything you kind of expected it would be at this stage? Do you still have the freedom that you had aspiration for as a running politician?
That's a really interesting question, Blake. And I'd have to say largely yes. I came to this, and I fully admit, with a lot of political naivety. I've always been on top of what I think good policy looks like and good public policy, but I certainly didn't understand fully the sort of undercurrents of politics that you know controls to a very large extent what happens at that level. And I've learned a lot since I became elected. Of course, I spent the first three and a half years as a lone representative in the House, and then Hannibal joined me. But we were always this sort of curiosity in the corner. Oh yeah, there's the Greens there. That isn't that fun. It's nice to have these newcomers and to be part of the conversation. But we weren't really considered, I don't think, until pretty close to the last election as a serious threat to be a, you know, established as a real political influencer here in the province. So, yeah, huge amount of enormous changes, both for me personally and for the party in adjusting to that.
You mentioned about, you know, the sort of the other parties kind of acknowledge they, you mean they can't ignore the Green Party. If you were an oddity in the corner last election, you are now driving policy today. Do your colleagues now appreciate you differently than they might have 2 years ago?
I think so. I mean, the sense I get is that we had to prove ourselves. I had to prove myself personally after I got elected and demonstrate to Islanders that we deserved to have a place in the legislature, that the Green Party was not, you know, whatever prejudices or misconceptions they had, you know, as a single issue party, as a fringe party, as, you know, as a party that wouldn't understand the full spectrum of political ideas and what it takes to be a mature party. So I had to prove myself personally. And then now that we are in official opposition, we have to prove ourselves again and again and again every day, because unlike the other parties who've been established and been in that legislature for 180 years plus, nobody questions whether they have a right to be there or if they deserve to be there. But for the Green Party, we have to earn the respect and the comfort of the electorate here, of the citizens, that, you know, our friends and neighbours on Prince Edward Island. And that's not something I take for granted. And I know that every single member of my caucus understands that there's a fragility about our presence there. And until we can show that we deserve to be the official opposition in the role that we occupy now, and that we are worthy of continued support, then we are working really hard just to establish that level of comfort and confidence and credibility. And I don't take any of that for granted, not a single thing.
No, I mean, I'm interested because the last session, the Liberals were in, I think Jamie Foxx had a couple of private member bills as an opposition member. You've had a lot of success in passing, amending, being involved with legislation thus far. What are some of the best parts of being an official opposition in this environment? And, you know, is there as much collaborative discussion as it might appear that there is from the outside? That might be a tough question. So,
I guess it's a good one. It's a really important one, and one that we're still working out. Just this morning, I had a meeting with the minister, and it's clear to me that our ideas of what collaboration mean are quite different. And within our caucus, you know, we're the official opposition. We were supported by 30% of Islanders. It's our duty to bring forward to the House ideas that represent the constituency that said, these are the people that we would like to be represented by in the House. So all of our legislation, and you're right, you know, unprecedented for an opposition party to have passed the number of bills that we have, 5, I think it is, in 2 sittings. Never happened before. So there's an element of, okay, we are here to present our ideas and to improve governance on Prince Edward Island and therefore the lives of Islanders, but we're also there to oppose government. We're there to hold them to account. And those two things are not mutually exclusive. You can do both of them simultaneously. So, and in fact, we have to do them both simultaneously.
And does that fracture relationships? Because on one hand, you're trying to collaborate. The other hand, you're trying to hold them to account. People don't like that responsibility to have to be...
It's an awkward dance. And I won't pretend otherwise. And it's new territory. It's not just new. I mean, obviously, it's new for the Greens because we've never sat in the legislature before. So we're all learning to varying extents what it means to be a legislator and what that role looks like. It's also new for the other parties who've been around forever and who sort of had established very rigid and accepted norms for what it takes to be government and opposition. And we're sort of playing around with that. And not playing around. That's too trite a phrase. We're changing that.
Yeah.
And again, we are both providing improvement and opposition. And I think we're learning that there's a real balance to be had there. And that's awkward. It is.
Yeah.
It's awkward at a personal level, but also collectively. You know, there's a lot of people out there who feel that we're too cozy. We have a blue-green alliance here. And that's actually not what's happening at all. You know, there's been some blistering letters to the editor. You may have seen one today, you know, from our health critic. From our ag critic, from our education critic, from environment critic. I mean, really hard hitting critiques, both within
the house. Which is appropriate.
That's absolutely, that's what we do. But somehow people are not seeing that, or perhaps we're not giving that aspect of our role of holding government to account enough emphasis. So you might see over the next year or so a slight change in emphasis from us as an official opposition. And yes, we still want to get our work done, and we want to make sure that the government bills that come forward are what we feel is a good policy. But we also have to make sure that the Dennis King government is doing the job that it was elected to do. And I'm increasingly less comfortable with that. Let me put it that way.
It's interesting. So just watching as an observer, the first year, and we're coming up to the, I guess, the third session probably, yep, since you've been elected, things are very harmonious. I think everybody in that house, including the Liberals, who aren't used to the position they found themselves in, they're trying to figure out, get their balance and understand their roles. Now, this third session, years past, I'm kind of curious to watch how people position themselves. Is that collaborative mentality still the driving force, or are people starting to stake their own claims? And we could be in election cycle soon. So positioning to answer that question, but just as an observation, we have to be within some visible range of an election, and will this collaborative style continue to hold? Anyway, I won't post
like you. We talked about too, like this is, and you said it multiple times, that this is a first on many fronts, the first minority in however many years, and like an actual minority because there's a three-party system, the first time that opposition has actually been really listened to, I guess, in PEI, not listened to that extent, but more had
influence.
Exactly, had more influence is a better word. Yeah. So I guess scaling back a bit, my question is, you and Hannah went from 2 seats, then election night happened, then you ramped up to 8 seats right away. What was that process like from going from, okay, we're in the basement of the legislature to, okay, shit, now we got to look, we need staff for this? Because a lot of people,
may or may not have been said.
I worked as a political staffer, so I kind of see from that perspective, because a lot of people, Joe Blow on the street thinks, oh, it's just a politician, like they don't have any support system. Mm-hmm.
But there's infrastructure.
That's the infrastructure, you need that support system behind you to run your social media, your policy writing, your research. You're not a one-man show. Like it takes a team approach. So those, let's say, 2 to 3 weeks leading up to the kind of switchover of government, what was going through your head?
You know what? We spent an enormous amount of time prepping our new MLAs, and 6 of our MLAs, as you just suggested, Sam, were brand new, green, not just in terms of their alignment politically, but also in terms of their naivety, you know? And we spent huge amounts of time and effort preparing them for what life in the legislature looks like and feels like. Because until you've done that, there really is, there's nothing like it, and there's no way that you can fully describe what the pressures are like, what the opportunity. I mean, it's a joy as well, but it's a challenge in every day. And you're scrutinized in a manner that you will never have been part of before. Plus, again, I talked earlier about the fact that we had to establish ourselves as being worthy of being inside that rail. And I think people were expecting, perhaps, some would have been anticipating and looking forward to, but they were expecting us to struggle. You know, how are they going to cope with the funny rules that, you know, go on? Nobody behaves in real life like you do inside the rail. You know, there's all kinds of weird rules and regulations and norms and traditions.
Rules from 150 years ago. It's not rules from today's standard.
So that's not something, as you just rightly said, Sam, you don't do that by yourself. There's a huge support network that does that. So I was blessed prior to all of the 6 new arrivals coming to have fantastic staff, smart, hardworking, you know, knowledgeable, had experience in the civil service, some of them, most of them actually. So we sort of gained that institutional knowledge, which was entirely lacking in our party, through gathering the right people around. And I spent a huge amount of time in my first term in office as the sole MLA, Green MLA, trying to make sense of what was there and reading the rule book and getting my head around how that place works. So we tutored our MLAs relentlessly. And you know what? I think the evidence would show that we have sort of slotted into that environment, that very strange and unique and challenging environment, in a very admirable way. You know, I look around the people who are sitting in the same corner of the room as myself, and I'm astonished at how well they have adapted to the
atmosphere. I think there certainly was some underestimating done, because even I would flick it on like Facebook or whatever just for the during when the house is sitting and say, yeah, wow, like that's a very good question, or that's a good answer. Like they clearly they did a little bit of research before just putting their name on a poster and saying you want to be elected. So moving forward, as the smallest jurisdiction in Canada, where can PEI demonstrate leadership, and how do you think this could be achieved?
You know, we sit as an equal partner around the federal table when the first ministers gather. And that's a real gift, that gift of jurisdiction that we have here for a community of 155,000.
If you want to compare populations, yeah, exactly.
Sure. But we do sit as an equal partner. You know, we have all of the levers of power that every other province has to determine a lot of the big files, you know, education, healthcare, and, you know, and on and on and on. A lot of the really heavy lifting is done at the provincial level, or at least the responsibility and the jurisdiction falls provincially. So we have that opportunity sitting around that table. Of course, we'll never have the economic clout that an Ontario or a BC or a Quebec does, and we understand that. And I think, but what we can have is a moral, we can have a moral suasion as equal partners around that table. And I do think, Sam, to answer your question, there's a huge opportunity here for PEI to demonstrate leadership in all kinds of areas. We can be the model or the beacon, if you like, whether we're talking about instituting what sustainable development looks like, what a patient-centered healthcare system looks like, what an education system that supports the unique needs of every student looks like, what a basic income guarantee can look like. You know, all of these big programs where to institute them across a nation all at once would be incredibly difficult.
Microcosm, maybe.
Sure.
And we've been called almost like an incubator for the rest of Canada, but I think it's past that now, because we actually, like you said, we're equal in the sense of from the federal government, but we're also, we're punching above our weight in almost everything we do. So it's not, we're no longer an example. Like we are an example, but we're not this cute little province. Like we're punching above our weight in many sectors.
Sort of like the Green Party in the in the legislature.
That's
yeah.
Fair.
So you get frustrated with limitations, because you've had what you've just described are pretty aspirational, and the needle moves very slowly here. So I know in business sometimes you want to get things done, and you just can't. You're obstructed by things beyond your control. Mm-hmm. Do you find this limiting?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I came from the business world. I ran essentially a small business as an independent dental practitioner here on the island. I learned a huge amount through doing that, by the way, that is applicable and useful in my life as a politician, but that's a separate thing.
We'll have you back for another podcast.
We can talk about dentistry.
So, to answer your question more directly, Blake, I knew that government operates at a glacial speed. We all know that. No, that's not a surprise to anybody, and the frustrations of not being able to get things done as easily as one might in the
envision trying to push things forward. Yeah.
However, I have learned that without losing sight of the long-term vision or goal that you're heading towards, whether that be from a policy point of view or from a societal point of view, very rarely do you make big leaps in politics. Usually it's little steps. And it's been a difficult thing as leader of the Green Party, who has some, you know, pretty different ideas from, you know, the traditional parties, the established parties, the old line parties here. And there are some within the party who, partly because of a lack of experience in politics and also because of an impatience with some of the, because of the severity and the acuteness of some of the problems we face, they want things done now. You know, we need to be carbon neutral tomorrow. And that's just practically not possible within the confines of politics. I'm choosing a particularly glaring example here. Personally, I've come to the place of comfort where I understand that things are going to always take much longer than you imagine, and it's always more complicated than you first imagine when you come across the issue.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you can't get things done, and sometimes things can move quickly, and that's one of the things that sort of gives me hope for the future of not just the island but of humanity in general, is that when we are faced with a really critical problem in our faces,
we can respond.
And humanity has that ability to be creative and to come together and face these big issues when we have to.
So you mean, I've got four children. You mentioned one of the motivators for you to enter political life, which is not a rewarding vocation, in my opinion, these days. I mean, it's a difficult vocation. What do you see as the future of PEI? So if you were to look out to the horizon and post your political contribution, what do you see as the future for PEI? And how is it going to be better for my children as well as yours and those that come after?
If I have children, maybe, yeah.
Well, you know,
I have to get a girlfriend first.
Well, that's why we're doing an audio podcast, not a video.
Oh, that's a serious question. And I just have to recalibrate.
Well, you know, because it is a kind of a, if you do move the needle in increments, we have a saying internally here, we make progress, not perfection. So as long as we're driving toward a vision, we might not get all the way, but as long as we're pushing in that direction, that's good. Mm-hmm. You know, I think PEI has a ton of potential. You look at even growth forecasts economically and population, but we also have some pretty serious challenges we have to address. So aside from rising sea level, what's going to happen? What's PEI going to look like? And is it going to be an environment that my children can, you know, be comfortable staying? Or should people be looking at their exit plans?
Hmm. Yeah. So how am I going to come at the answer to this, Blake? Let me start this way. I mean, there is no planet PEI. We're attached, of course, in every way, economically, socially, and environmentally to the rest of Canada and to the rest of the world. So our future is inextricably linked to the future of the maritime provinces and humanity and, you know, and the fate of the world. So having said that, I think there are some unique opportunities that we have here on PEI. I actually moved here consciously because I think Prince Edward Island has an opportunity to, let me put it this way, to be a model of what it looks like to live well in the 21st century, to live sustainably. And I don't think there are many places in the world where such a model currently exists. Mm. But I do think we have the potential to do that. And part of that is that gift of jurisdiction I talked about earlier, that we have to a much greater extent than most other places the opportunity to chart our own course.
Is there a risk of losing that jurisdictional independence? Like, there's been talk of maritime union. Like, I'm not suggesting that would ever happen, but do you see, is it conceivable that we could lose that jurisdictional?
I think it is. I mean, it's a topic that comes round cyclically. I mean, it was talked about not very long ago, if I remember right. I can't remember which senator brought it up, but you know, but it, you know, it happens, and it's been going on since before Confederation. Well, no, I guess that's not true, but
a long time.
Pretty well since Confederation, this idea of maritime union. I desperately hope that it does not happen, and that's not to say that we cannot cooperate with our neighbors here in the maritime provinces. In fact, I think there's enormous potential here for regional cooperation on economic matters, on healthcare matters, on regulatory matters. For sure. I think there are real opportunities to collaborate with our neighbors here without losing, again, I like the phrase, the gift of jurisdiction, and it is a gift, and let's not ever, well, at least from my point of view, let's not ever consider giving that gift away.
Great.
So I kind of, it's changing a different path. There's issues today that maybe weren't issues 100 years ago, 50 years ago. Like, for one, every election, healthcare is an issue. Every election, infrastructure is an issue. But now there's more like mental health's an ongoing issue. Just social well-being is a bigger issue than it was even 20 years ago. How do you suggest, I'm not looking for a direct answer, but what's your opinion on, like, how can we balance the books in terms of financial stability on PEI, but also taking care of the issues that weren't issues 20 years ago?
Sure. You'd be familiar with the triple bottom line philosophy, which is, you know, we have to have in balance the economic bottom line, but also we have to look at the social balance sheet and the environmental balance
more
sheet.
More companies are being measured by that today.
Absolutely. Yeah. So as a government, I mean, I think it's always been incumbent on a government to keep all of those three things in view. Now, there are certain limits that we are pushing, which mean that environmental concerns and, to a certain extent, social concerns that perhaps weren't an issue 30 or 40 years ago.
They were uncovered almost.
Right.
Uncovered
almost. So there was it was okay for governments to have a more limited focus and to look at how are we going to grow GDP and in doing so improve the well-being of our citizens. Much more complicated now, because we can grow the GDP by cutting down all of our forests and turning them into 2x4s, and that's going to boost the GDP, but that's going to create an incredible environmental deficit. We cannot keep up our infrastructure, whether that's our schools that are literally falling down. You know, we have so many schools built in the 50s and 60s that are approaching the end of their So we have infrastructure deficits, which are causing social deficits, and we've sort of lost sight of that balance that we have to attain between economic, social, and environmental welfare. And your question, I think, Sam, was how do we keep sight of that? And I think one of the big challenges for every government, wherever you are in the world, is going to be reconnecting economic well-being, economic expansion, or economic development with social well-being. We have a situation here, and we're no exception to this, where we have had robust economic growth here. I mean, you know, we lead the country in many respects.
The last 5 years, yeah. I think we've had the highest growth. Yeah.
And you know, there are many good things about that. But if you do not, if that economic expansion and growth and development is disconnected from the welfare of ordinary islanders, then that's a problem. And I think if you look at the metrics that surround, you mentioned mental health in your question, Sam, housing is another one, access to, you know, basic services like healthcare and education, those things have not got better over the time that we've had this, you know, we've been on a tear, or we've been the mighty province, whatever, however you want to put it. If you look strictly at GDP figures, that's true. If you look at the wider, if you cast a wider view, and look at the well-being of individual islanders, you get a very different picture.
Much more disparity, I think.
Absolutely.
So from a financial, from a business perspective, yeah. I mean, there's only a couple of sources of revenue. We get 50% of our money from Ottawa, essentially, and then we tax. So there's only a few areas. So from a taxation perspective, how do you match the needs? And as Sam said, there's been a lot of issues that are prevalent today that weren't prevalent 10 years ago. Addictions, there's lots of social challenges. Housing is one. How do you manage a functional society without burdening the contributors? Because business is a little bit mobile, if they're taxed to a point where it's more efficient in a different jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. How do you keep business growing to supply the energy that's required to support society?
Mm-hmm. It's a conundrum for every government everywhere.
Forever.
Exactly.
I was hoping there's an answer. So.
Okay. So I'm asking everybody, where you're just now.
Yeah, but you know, it's a really serious point. I think our opportunity here on Prince Edward Island, I mean, I could go in 100 different directions to start answering that question, but I'm going to say that I think our economic future here on Prince Edward Island lies with a large number of small independent entrepreneurs establishing businesses all across this island. I think the opportunity to do that, you say that businesses are to a certain extent mobile, individuals are mobile, and capital is, you know, absolutely, and much more unregulated now than it ever has been. But I think quality of life is something that is absolutely fixed and that people are all looking for. We're all looking for quality of life. Mm. And I think there's a much larger awareness around the world that life, success in life has got much more, success is not just accumulation of material possessions and financial success as we might imagine it. It's much more about the quality of your relationships.
Well, it's growth too, like if you're growing as a person, like in Blake.
Absolutely.
Kind of, Blake, since I've only been here for half a year or whatever, but Blake's kind
best
of,
half year.
Blake kind of instilled me too, like you want to, essentially, it's work to learn versus work to earn. You want to be able to continually go, like, okay, I went from point A to point B and track those milestones. I'm smarter than I was 6 months ago. I know this much more. I have this much more skill set than I did 6 months ago.
I love that. I really love that.
That's a Mike Cassidy quote, the work to learn, not work to earn. Yeah. He teaches that a lot. But
you know, even at our
growth is everything to our company, especially.
For sure it is. And in our recruitment business, because we do patriate people here to PEI, and I think our active workforce today is 80,000 people, which is larger than it's ever been. Our population's growing. And it's people who choose to be here, not necessarily because they can make more money than they can in a different jurisdiction, but they choose this lifestyle. They choose the environment that this offers. And, you know, so I think there is
that's our magic
growth. Yeah. So how do we encourage more growth, encourage more participation in the economy? And that's what the fuel that you need to support the infrastructure that society needs.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. We won't keep you too much longer, but just picture this. There's a time when Peter Bevan Baker is no longer elected. For whatever reason, what do you want your? Yeah, it could be just because you age out. Who knows? You could be anywhere. What do you want your legacy to be on PEI and on the political process? It's an open ended question. We don't expect a pinpoint answer. But.
Yeah, you know, I've always approached politics as, I mean, I had no personal. If I wanted to be an elected representative, I would not have chosen the path that I did. This was not about fulfilling a personal ambition. I have not a burning desire to be the ruler of Prince Edward Island or anything like that. I was always motivated by improving the community in which I lived and where my kids were going to grow up, going back to the original question. So in terms of legacy, I've never sort of looked at this as, you know, what can I achieve and what will people remember me for? How will Prince Edward Island be enhanced by the presence of the ideas that I bring forward? I was extraordinarily ambitious for the ideas that I was representing and promoting. Not so much ambitious about, you know, becoming the leader of the official opposition or, heaven forbid, the premier someday. But I understand that those two things are inextricably linked. So if I, you know, I think already I could look back with a certain amount of satisfaction at the changes that have occurred here as a result of my presence in politics. I think the House is changed, I hope forever, in terms of the collegiality, the civility, the respect that is shown in there.
Is it sustainable? Because that's not an environment that normally gravitates to that type of decorum.
I think it is, Blake, but it will require constant vigilance and constant buy-in from those who
the right
who
people
are sitting
that
in the House.
All have they share. They might have different policies, but they share the same vision of PEI.
So if you attract the right people into the system, it'll maintain it.
I think so. A lot of it is dependent on good personal relations between individuals in the House. And I'm often asked, well, you know, what can we? Because people are watching PEI from all over the country, you know, and well, what the heck's going on there? And, you know, well, can you translate that? Can you export that to other legislatures? And my answer to that is a very clear no. Unless you have the level of deep respect that exists between the individual players here, and I'm talking about between myself and Dennis and the other members of the House, if that does not exist, you cannot build the level of trust required to give yourself the space to be vulnerable. And that's a hard thing. Politicians generally don't display their vulnerability very well. But we have an environment in there which allows that to happen. But it's a rare thing, and I'm not assuming that it will go on forever. But I do think that that has happened, not just because of me, because other people had to buy into that. But I was the first to go there, and so I'm proud of that. Of course, there are some legislative things that we have brought forward that, I mean, not necessarily by myself individually, but our caucus, which I'm extremely proud of. I'm proud of the party that has gathered around me. I'm proud of the work that every single one of my MLAs is doing, and looking forward to whatever life brings to me.
I have a good question maybe to close. I know we've got some other... You're a very busy politician. Appreciate your time coming.
You were able to come live from Studio A on Lower Grafton Street.
At the Confederation headquarters. Yeah. But, you know, you do have federal political experience. There is a federal leadership convention underway. Would you ever consider running for the leadership of the Tory party? And we'll leave it
non,
at that.
Non, monsieur!
I don't know if
it's a assez bien le français.
Yeah. So anyway, I think I just want to thank you, Peter, very
thank
much.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Sam. And yeah, we look forward to observing the legislature in the coming weeks and look forward to good things there. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Blake.
Well, thanks very much. That was Peter Bevan Baker's interview, the first that we've done on the exchange. Sam, what do you think? A pretty good conversation?
I think we had a very good conversation, especially because we didn't really, like, we knew what we were going to talk about to an extent, but it kind of grew from that, and we were able to kind of get his background and what he sees for the future of PEI in terms of both politics and just in general.
Yeah, it was a great, easy conversation. Certainly was a very charismatic, generous person to talk to. He was very accommodating, and we're delighted to have him as our first guest on the exchange. And we look forward to representing all kinds of political views and interests and people who've got perspectives on the economy. So you'll see more of that. In fact, next week we've got another great sort of presenter to participate on the exchange.
I think people will be interested, especially as a follow-up from Peter. I think they'll be really inclined to see what she has to say, or hear what she has to say, because she's a, I guess I gave half of it away, that it's a woman, but what she has to say from her perspective and what her experience holds.
And when you look at some of these conversations, even with Peter's, we talk about PEI's positioning not just amongst our citizens, but how we position farther afield, so globally, domestically, nationally. And I think this next presenter, or I guess guest, we'll call
guest,
it.
Yeah.
It was also a very generous and considerate guest. And these first people, we have a number of people who come on to this podcast without really understanding what it is they're agreeing to subscribe to. And Peter, to his credit, he came in and was, you know, probably didn't know really what was going to happen. But everybody who's come on so far, and we do have a few of these recorded, has been really considerate with the time. And I think as these roll out, we'll see more people being
And I think it's an easy way for us to focus on the leadership of these people and what they contribute to, whether it's island politics, island economy, island just community in general. It's able to kind of portray their story, what they might not, what the public might not have known about them. We can kind of shed that light in a little less polished version, I suppose, and a little more authentic.
Yeah, well, this is an authentic. It's a high budget, but very authentic.
Live from our studio on Grafton Street.
Yeah, Studio A. And sometime we might move to Studio B once we get a little bit more equipment. Should we announce who our next guest is on the exchange?
I don't know. I think we'll keep it quiet.
We'll do it.
Yeah, we'll release a teaser later on.
So we know it's a female, and we know it's a well-regarded personality, but we don't know much else. So I guess
you can do some Googling with that, but I don't think you'll find a whole lot.
Not well. Could be a lot of people anyway.
So what else is on the next week in terms of? I guess there wasn't a whole lot politically maybe to look at, but any economic factors or economic trends?
We know something that we did, and it's broadcast actually on our Confederation Group website, is the article that was really picked up by a few locations on the softening of our economy.
Right.
And the kind of the example I cited was around school closures and the impact of weather anomalies and how our future leaders may be getting affected by this culture. We did an article in The Guardian, then that was picked up by CBC, and it's kind of resonated every time there's a little bit of a flurry.
I think you like getting the phone calls from CBC now. You're getting used to it. It's been a couple of past months.
Happy to get calls from anybody. Happy to get calls for work. So
there you go.
If anybody in government are listening, we always are open to projects. But yeah, I think that's something that we'll touch on a little bit because it does have some resonance, and
right.
We still have some bad weather coming another month or so.
We don't want to give too much away, so that's probably a good place to end. So this has been the inaugural episode, the number one episode of The Exchange, presented by Confederation Group. I'm Sam McPhail. With me is my co-host, Blake Doyle, and we bid you farewell.
Thanks very much.